Lecture 36, Finale, Masterclass.
If I bought this set and I hadn't made it myself and wasn't a linguist, maybe that doesn't make sense, but you get my meaning, I probably would have expected that it would concern word histories more than it does. And in fact, I have resisted dwelling upon those too much. My sense has been that only after we have a full conception of how inherent change is to a language can we understand the etymologies as more than just so stories. Butterfly collecting is okay. I used to have an insect collection when I was young. It kept me from being able to attract women for several years. But system and principle are often more interesting than just collection and individuality. So now that we're at the end of our journey, I think it'll be useful to take a simple sentence of English and examine the extent to which it is a snapshot along an endless series of processes of mutation with which you are all now familiar. The histories of the words are now useful to us in that they can illuminate how these processes have happened. So our sentence will be, while the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. There's one of those old chestnut sentences that we find ourselves saying all the time. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. Where did all that come from? This time, word for word. Nothing about sentences and word order and pragmatic particles. Just where did those words come from, word by word? Well, let's take while. While is a nice example of grammaticalization. In Proto-Indo-European, there was a verb, quae, and that meant to rest, quae. That's what while goes back to. So there's while the snow fell, that goes back to somebody laying back on a couch. Well, in Old English, this verb, quae, became a noun, huil. And to give you a sense of how those things could be related, the qu, which is this labialized K, became an H. So qu becomes h. There's a relationship there. It's common. So huil becomes a peaceful stretch of time. So huil is this while, just like if you say spend a while. And this is started with the verb to rest, but now it's a matter of the period of time that goes by while you're doing the resting. But it's still a noun. It's a concrete concept. It's a huil. But then it grammaticalized. It became a grammatical word showing that one thing happened within the same span of time than another. So there was one part of the meaning that ended up sort of going grammatical, and that was the aspect that referred to the time. If you rest, then presumably that happens over a stretch of time. You don't rest for a nanosecond, or if you do, you don't do it well. So there's this sense that this quae-ness, this wheelness, involves not only resting, but a stretch of time. Then the word grammaticalizes as a marker of time having stretched, instead of to the rest. So for that reason, while today, when we say while the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee, doesn't seem to have any relationship to quae, to rest, but that's where it came from, step by step by step. So the first word in that sentence is an example of grammaticalization beyond, for example, how pas came to mean not in French, etc. Grammaticalization is everywhere. It is peeking behind, from out from behind the posts of all sorts of words in any sense. Then, while the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. The. The is another grammaticalization. It comes from the Old English word for that. So to say the cat is to point out a certain cat as opposed to a cat, which refers to any cat. But to say that cat is to be more forcefully specific. It's that cat right there. And you're saying that, and the cat is looking at you with its big eyes and wondering why you're pointing to it. That's very specific. But a meaning that's that vivid generally tends to weaken over time. So the word terrible used to mean like a giant squid. There are squid that are over 50 feet long. That's terrible. Now we think of terrible as scrambled eggs that are a little bit runny. Vivid meaning tends to bleach. In the same way, that over time comes to mean just the. Not necessarily that cat right there in the corner, but the cat that's specific enough that we know that we talked about it, as opposed to a cat. So that means that a language like Old English, and to even more of an extent, Proto-Indo-European, these were languages that were like Chinese and many, many others that do not have articles like this. These things happened over time. So English is one of the languages that has developed this the-ness, but that was not part of its original legacy. It's a frill, and it seems as peculiar and superfluous to many foreigners as inalienable possession or evidential marking do to us. So that's the. So two grammaticalizations at the beginning of this sentence. So, while the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. Snow. Now, snow is an ordinary English word. You can say it without the Henry Aldrich voice crack, and you can say snow is an ordinary English word, which has had the same meaning for eons. However, the S in snow is kind of a mystery, really. In a way, if that word had come down in an ordinary way, it should be no, as in N-O-W. There shouldn't be that S there. And the reason that I say that is because if you look at other Indo-European words, they have their cognate to snow, but often there is no S. And so, for example, Latin had nix, and then French has neige, and Spanish has nieve. Notice it's not snege, it's not nieve, it's just N. And so what's going on? Now, you might think that maybe in, say, Latin, the S just dropped off. And, of course, things like that can happen. We saw that happening with, say, sister-in-law in Proto-Indo-European, snusos, and then it can go down as far in some daughter languages as nu. So it could be that. But there's a wrinkle here. It doesn't seem to be as simple as that the Latin word used to be snix, which sounds like some kind of breakfast cereal. Because actually there are other cases where Latin has an S and then a related language doesn't. And so, for example, Latin has specit for sees, as in he sees, she sees that cat or something like that, specit. And, of course, we have speculate from that root. But then if you look in Sanskrit, which was a sister ancient Indo-European language to Latin, then instead of spicit, you have patsyati. And all you have to realize is that it kind of should be spatsyati, but it's just patsyati. It's the same root, except Latin has this S, and Sanskrit doesn't. You find all sorts of cases like that where the sum total of the development of Indo-European seems to involve this pesky little S that pops up here and pops up there, little bit here, a little bit there, for no explainable reason. What this means is that that S was some sort of prefix that had some sort of meaning. Language is not that random, or at least not for long. Generally, when you see something like that, it traces to something that made some sort of darn sense at some point. That S was a prefix. We'll never know what meaning that prefix had, because Proto-Indo-European is dead. We can reconstruct, but there are questions that we will always have. There are no speakers, we can't ask anybody, and the language wasn't written. But it's clear that there was something. But whenever we say that it's snowing, we are using a remnant of what, to some human being a very long time ago, was a meaningful prefix of some kind. We still go, and whenever we do like that, it's a remnant of something that was more meaningful in the past. So it's kind of like throwing rice at a bride. You know, why do you throw this grain at the poor woman after a wedding? It seems almost savage, really. Yay, you're married, now we're going to put this crap in your hair. Why? Now, there's some obscure reason, one assumes, probably some savage, pagan reason, but we just do it because it's vaguely fun and because, well, it's not fun, really. Everybody else did it. You have to find the rice, it makes the bride dirty and frustrates her, and now with contacts, it might even get into her eyes. But you just do it because everybody else did it. In the same way, we're saying snow instead of no as just a gesture like that. So, while the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. Well, what about fell? Fell is a peculiar case, too. With fell, what we're dealing with is evidence of a suffix that's completely gone. So it's not fossilized like this peculiar S prefix, which is called the S mobile by Indo-European specialists. But this is a suffix that's just gone. But we have to reconstruct that the suffix was there. So remember that it's fall, fell. It's not falled. If anybody says falled, they're either a foreigner or they're just trying to get on your nerves. It's fell. But why? Because if you think about it, you're sitting under a tree. You don't have enough to do. You decide to make up a language, and you don't know German or English or any Germanic language, so you don't have that model. And if you made up a language on the spot, chances are that if you wanted to have some way of putting a verb in the past, there's certain things you would do, but you would not decide to change the vowel in the middle of the word. That wouldn't be a spontaneous decision. You're going to come up with an ending. You're going to put some word before or after. You're going to point your thumb backwards whenever the word is uttered, something. But you're not going to decide we're going to change the vowel. That's kind of counterintuitive. That sort of thing only happens by accident over time. What happens is that vowel got pulled astray by a seductive, influential suffix that then ran away and left the vowel permanently colored. So, for example, before there was a such thing as English in an early Germanic stage, it used to be that there was a word foot for foot, for foot, and then there was footy, and that was the plural. So foot, footy. So plural was real easy. It was just you stick e on the end. But sounds affect each other. Sounds change. Language tends to stew. Now e is a sound that's pronounced up top and in front of your mouth. E. It's up in there. You can make the sound yourself and see that it's E. It's up in the front. On the other hand, O is a sound where if you make it round your lips, you can feel that it's kind of in the middle rather than up top, and it's in the back rather than in the front. So E, O. It's kind of pulling back. Now, over time, people saying forty would start anticipating that they were going to have to make a sound high up in the front by pulling the O further to the front. And if you pull O to the front, then it becomes A. So O, A. And then if you go one step higher up front, you're back up with E again. So E. So O, E, E. So people started saying feti instead of forty, because it just felt more natural. It felt better. The principle of least effort does play a part in how language changes. So now you have the singular as fot, and then your plural is no longer foti. It's not that simple anymore. Now it's feti. And so you have both that plural ending, and there's this little vowel change. But in your mind, it's still, if you're a speaker of this stage of the language, what the plural ending is the e. Then you happen to know that, well, the O changes to E, and I don't know why, and I don't care because life is hard because there's no electricity yet or something like that. So, feti. But then remember that final vowels are very fragile. And so if you've got this feti with this little E hanging off like that, you know that that one is not long for this world. So pretty soon, feti is going to become fate. But then think about the situation you've got. Singular foot is foot. Now plural foot is fit. So really you've just got this little vowel change to indicate it. Now then, remember the great vowel shift. Remember how Chaucer woke up one morning and all of a sudden everybody sounded different? And remember how, of course, it was not that sudden. But remember how all of the vowels moved in a certain way. And so that meant that what started out as foot, and notice that foot is still spelled that way, moved up and became foot. And then fate became feet. But right at the point of fot and fate, you had this vowel inside changing. But that vowel changed because of the seductions of E. E kind of left it pregnant and then disappeared. And so then it was fate. But that wouldn't have happened if there had never been any E at the end. That was required. It had to be that vowel coloring that happened. So that's why it's fall, fell. It's not just because somebody was angry and created something that didn't make any sense. And it's not because somebody did it on purpose in general. It's because of a suffix that's long gone but left behind its calling card in terms of this vowel change, which has a cute name. You hear a lot about umlaut. That's called oblaut. And so that's there. Now then, on the other hand, we have to remember from Lecture 25 that it could be, might be, that verbs like fall change their vowel like that because of ancient mixture with a Semitic language that Proto-Germanic may have encountered, because Semitic languages have vowel changes like that for lunch. It's not the kind of exception that it is in English. So it could be that when we say that the temperature fell, that this is a legacy from people whose descendants now live in Tel Aviv, Cairo, and Addis Ababa. So, while the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. Does that sound like Walter Cronkite? While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. Well, she is what we're on now. She is an odd case, too. Nobody's quite sure about she. She's not right. It shouldn't be she. It should be something else. The English word for she was hea. Just like hea. Now, the thing is, H's don't become sh. That's not the usual. There's certain sound changes that are so common that they're almost predictable. But H going to sh is almost implausible. That's not what happens. So one wonders, why is it he and she when it used to be he and hea? Well, for one thing, Old English still had three genders, like a good Germanic language often does. And this included the definite article, or the definite article that was developing from the demonstrative. It was in between at that point. And the masculine was se, and the feminine was sea, and the neuter was that. And so if you have se, sea, and that as your masculine, feminine, and neuter, then you've got a kind of a similarity. There's sea, and then you have your hea. So hea is she, and sea is how you say that if you're talking about that cat. So maybe people began associating the hea with the sea, because there's kind of a meaning between she and that girl, in a way. So if you saw several girls and you said that one is wearing green in Old English, then you would say that Seah is wearing green. There's a short step from there to maybe thinking of that as meaning she is wearing green. So maybe that was what changed he, hea into he and then something like Seah and then that evolving into our own she. But this is not clear from documentation. We're not quite sure. There's a massive she puzzle, believe it or not. There's a whole literature about, like, where does she come from? Because it's not supposed to be that. It's supposed to be some other word beginning with H. And so maybe the reason that there was this desperate move into Seadam was because it was kind of hard to distinguish between he and hea. But nobody from back then can tell us what was going on, because last time we checked, they're still very dead. And so it's just a puzzle. It's the she puzzle. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. But what about arrive? Arrived, in particular. Arrived is quite the hayride, actually. Arrive is borrowed from French. And we'd be surprised if every word from this sentence was borrowed from old, was directly descended from Old English. I've made sure that most of the words were, because I wanted to use things like this. But let's make it real English, and so arrived. Now, the native word for arrive is come, of course. I've often even said, and I've proven to be wrong, that arrive is not a word you use in casual speech. Just like I don't think of people using the word return. You know, I'll be returning tonight at 6. No, you come back. In the same way, I used to say nobody says arrive. You say come. You know, when my mother came, I put the cake in her hand. But I've noticed a lot of people use arrive. People use it very casually. People use it eating chicken. So apparently arrive is a word. But the native word is come. That's the good, you know, old English word. And often the French word is more formal. And even though people for some reason insist on using arrive, it is the more formal word. I don't think that longshoremen are much given to using the word, for example. So you have pig and pork. You've got come and arrive. But arrive actually started as an idiomatic expression in vulgar Latin. Vulgar not meaning Latin that picked its nose, but Latin that was spoken by ordinary people. Arrive came from ad ripam, and what that meant was to the shore. And so there was this verb ad ripare, which was a created verb, like saying, I got to the shored. It was that kind of thing. And so it was an expression, really, to ad ripare, to get to the shore. And then ad ripare became arripare, with two R's, because the D became more like the R it was next to. That's assimilation, a normal sound change. And by the time Latin had become Old French, it wasn't arripare, it was arrivé. So, we borrowed the word from French, and we have no idea when we say arrive that we're actually saying something that began as two words and as kind of a cute, cocky expression in vulgar Latin. We just say arrive. Then there's the past tense ending ed, and we're not exactly sure where that ending comes from, but some people have said that at an earlier stage of Germanic, that ed was born from the word that meant did. So it's kind of like walked came from the equivalent at an earlier stage of walk did. And it's a decent explanation given various other things that you can bring to bear on the argument. And that would mean that arrived has three original words in it, ad, ripam, and did, from two different languages, Latin and some kind of early Germanic, all kludged together as arrived. I think that's really neat. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. Well, what about two? Two's kind of dull. It goes back to an old English word, to. The only thing that's interesting about that is that the to, just like foot became foot, to changed and it became an u. So just like food begins as food, which is what the spelling actually looks like if you can peel away how used to we are seeing two O's and thinking of it as an U. It's really a long O. Food became food. To became two. And so that's two. So the great vowel shift changed to. But two is an old head. It has gray hair, and it knows the score, and it has a down-home accent. I'll stop. Anyway, then there's ask. And ask is an interesting case. It traces back to an old English word, which is askion. But despite how we feel about good old axe today, I'm going to axing. In old English documents, axion is as common as askion, and these are people writing in very formal settings. It's just a matter of alternation. It's kind of like she's not at home. She isn't at home. Where do you put the contraction? She's not at home or she isn't at home. There's no meaning difference. It doesn't have anything to do with how sophisticated you are. It's just what linguists call free variation. Well, askion, axion used to be the same thing. So our contemporary sense that there's something extremely green acres and remiss about axe is quite arbitrary, really, because there were times when you would say that while eating the eggs of rare fish. So things change for reasons that are different from the ones that we would think about. While the snow fell, she arrived to axe about their fee. Well, what about? The axe was deliberate. About is a matter of the rebracketing that we saw create words like alone. Remember how alone comes not from and lone, but it comes from all and one put together, so alone. That was from a lecture that I did back in the 1700s, one of the early lectures, but you may remember alone, all one. So that happens all the time, and that's what happened with about. About starts as at, by, and out, and pronounced rapidly over time, they became about. You don't want to say at by out. That was annoying just to do that. And so it's going to streamline, and so it becomes about. Just as God be with you became goodbye. And now we just kind of think it's about good and something called a by, and we're too busy to realize that there's no such thing as a by. That's because it used to be God be with you. So that's what about comes from. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their feet. Now we're up to there. What's there? There is another one that's not supposed to be there. English pronouns are a bizarre little mess in terms of historical development. Our word for there in Old English was hiera, and I've always thought that was a nice name. I would hope that after people are finished naming their little girls Heather, as they so often do these days, that Hiera would be a nice name. I think it would be beautiful. Maybe I'll name my little girl Hiera McWhorter. But it was a fine word, and for some reason we took from the Scandinavians there. That was an Old Norse word. Vikings came, they had their word for there, and they married into our families and came into our schools and took over our folkways as if it was me. And all of a sudden, people who were speaking English were using there. Now, when people are lending words to a language that are that intimate, you know that probably those people are affecting the transmission of the language. So we've talked about how English is a little simpler than it should be, and it's things like there that show it. It's one thing if English borrows a word like skirt from the people. That's fine. But when it's getting into your pronouns, when it's getting into the grammar, when it's getting into the traffic monitors like that, then you get the feeling that you have people who are learning your language incompletely and desperately filling in gaps with things they're familiar with from their own language. That's going to leave your language affected over time. So there is a sign of that having happened. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. So now we come to fee. Fee has a kind of twisted little history. We took it from Norman French, and they had a word. Believe it or not, it was fee. Fee started as fief. And the French had taken that word. If you realize that doesn't sound very French, and that's because it wasn't. They had taken that word from the language of the Germanic-speaking invaders who had come and changed their land. Remember that the Normans were originally Norsemen. These were Vikings who had stayed over on the continent instead of bothering people in England. And so English borrowed a word from French that had borrowed a word from one of English's ancestors still on the continent. So there's just this trading of words. Then there's more. The Proto-Germanic word had been fehu, and you can see how that would have become fi. But this was an example of the weird Grimm's Law that changed Proto-Indo-European P's into F's, for example, like pater becomes father. So we're going to trace it back. Fehu in Proto-Germanic, father in Germanic, well, pater in Proto-Indo-European. In Proto-Indo-European, the fehu was peku. Now, we're back in Proto-Indo-European. Fi is not the only thing that happened to peku, but peku in Proto-Indo-European meant wealth or property, and we can follow it into other places like Latin, where there wasn't a Grimm's Law to distort it so much. And peku became things quite recognizable like pecuniary. But pecuniary, of course, is an English word. We borrowed that from the Latin form of the word, but that means that fee and pecuniary trace to the same root in Proto-Indo-European. Also peculiar. So fee and peculiar trace back to the same root. That's how deep and marvelous and random and bizarre language change can be. While the snow fell, she arrived to ask about their fee. All of that is in that one sentence, and we can understand all of that based on what we've seen in this course. So the idea has been to show that any sentence of English, when you view it up close, is a kind of petri dish of disparate elements that are stewing together. And all of this is a testament to the long history of one of the first language's 6,000 living branches, just one of them, and all of the ways that it has mutated and mixed with other branches. And, of course, we can see similar stories in any sentence from any of the 6,000 languages in the world. So I hope in this course to have shown that the world's languages are a wonderful thing. They're dynamic systems. They are symbiotic systems in their way. And they're in a constant state of flux. Sometimes that flux is predictable in fascinating ways. Sometimes that flux is surprising in enchanting ways. And under this perspective, I hope I've shown that language is not just a basket of words, and it's not just a basket of words knit together by a collection of rules that we learn in school and usually fall short of. But a language is one of the many wonders of being human. Thank you very much.
We genuinely hope you have enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.